If you enjoy this podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all future episodes. Also, check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/switchboxtv for video versions of this show, plus loads more videos covering sport, music, and lifestyle. That's youtube.com/switchboxtv. This episode was recorded in August 2020. Welcome to the Need to Know Music Show here on Switchbox TV. And today I'm joined by an amazingly versatile singer-songwriter from Croydon, just south of London. He's had an extraordinary career path of chart success, collaborations and variety. We are definitely going to struggle to cover it all in one interview, but we're going to give it a go. So please welcome David McColman. How are you doing?
I'm very good. How are you? Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, absolutely. Absolute pleasure. How have you found the last few months? How's lockdown and kind of how have you found the last few months of our COVID times?
Well, I think I'm like everybody else. It's strange. I've experienced anxiety. I've had some depression. I've drunk too much. I've eaten too much. I've worked out a lot, taken a lot of walks, done a lot of creativity. And felt really overwhelmed by the need that people I know seem to have for things to return to the way they were. And so there have been these days, like one day this week, I just had this enormous influx of requests because I teach. So my boss wanted what I was going to be looking at next term. So I had to write that for him, and then people need me to do performances because it's Bandcamp day, and then I need to write a song, and then I need to do it. Yeah, it's just like that. And if I'm running around like I usually do, and I'm burning off all of the calories because I'm running around so much, I don't drive or anything, it's fine. But yeah, it's just a very weird time. I mean, I needed the break. This is the kind of year that I wanted to have, but it's in the worst possible circumstances. And it's very unnerving. And we're all, you know, so many people that I know are still here and they've been untouched by it. And it feels a bit like the sword of Damocles sometimes.
Yeah, I think a lot of artists have sort of found the time to create and sort of be more introspective. Has that been the case with you?
Well, I've been working on material with Hi-Fi Sean. I don't know if you know about that.
Yes, you know, I was listening to you. You've got a single out at the moment, haven't you? So I've been listening to that.
Yes, Sean and I have been working together since 2016.
Oh, okay.
I did one of the tracks on his FT record, and then we created a set. We created a full album. Which was all ready to go, but then the lockdown happened, and that just kicked everything into touch. So we've got this album that's just sitting there on ice.
Listen to the warning, if it's working out, it's wearing you out. Bunker to bunker, boy you need a kicking like a fast moving train in a slow moving city. Are you free? Are you in recovery? Who do you believe? Somebody had a whitey at a party, but you're long gone. And this is the wrong buzz, and it's a symphony of nothing, and here's another Christmas. And you don't need to mess with the timing, because the timing's good. Do you read me? through my periscope. Now that it's longer.
The thing with me, I mean, I've got to stop calling it a problem. The thing with me is that I do, I'm a top line writer and I'm a lyricist and I can play guitar slightly. I can get a decent groove out of a chord if I spend a couple of days trying to do that. But it's not what I think about when I wake up in the morning. I don't think about music. I think about what can be added. And not everybody who asks you to add something has something that you want to add to. So it means that I spend time waiting around for someone who has something, you know, a sound that excites me. And Sean was, I worked with Alex, but Alex and my thing, my relationship with Alex began live, because that's how I've been doing most of my music for like the last 10 years. I've been doing live songbook shows and jazz shows. And so Alex and I got together for a Billy Strayhorn show. And then he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd love to do a Billie Holiday show. And then he said, do you want to do an album? And the amazing thing about that album was that it was over in 2 days. And, you know, there was a bit more to it than that. But the actual recording of it was like bish, bash, bosh, in and out, which is something that I'd always heard of but never done.
Lady, sing the blues. She's got bad. She feels so sad. Wants the world to know just what the blues is all about.
Just want to take it back to the beginning, if that's okay. So you were born in Croydon, but you moved back to Guyana when you were 11. That was where your mum was from. Is that correct?
Yes, my mother had been here for 16 years by 78. So I'm in 78. That's when we left.
And you were 11 at that. You were 11 years old at that stage.
I was. Strange time to leave somewhere permanently.
I was going to say, how was that? How did you find the difference in, like, I know, I mean, this is, we kind of concentrate mostly on music, but it's all feeds into your growing as a human being. So how did you find going from Croydon to Guyana? So was it a real culture shock?
Huge. My mother's a country woman. So we didn't just go to Guyana. We went to the Guyanese countryside. So I went from Gorston-on-Sea, which is provincial, but it's still a town, to a village on the west coast of the Babese River. And then no TV, no comics, no apples, no flour, like no boiled sweets, nothing that I was familiar with, no Top of the Pops. And heat and mosquitoes and Caribbean music, which was like soca, calypso, reggae, and American hit parade music, and gospel. And that was something, I mean, my music knowledge here was Radio 1, Top of the Pops, Swap Shop. You know, it was all of that stuff. But in Guyana, it was completely brand new. But I say that, and I think if I had not gone there, that I wouldn't have got to know people like Stevie Wonder and Earth, Wind & Fire as well, because that wasn't really in my mother's musical vocabulary. She let us watch Top of the Pops and she liked her crooners.
Oh, okay.
So yes. Until I hit Guyana, I was being raised on whatever was on Top of the Pops in the 1970s, and Perry Como and Dean Martin and Bing Crosby and people like that. That was the music in the house.
So did you think that for that... Oh, sorry, slight delay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. So did that? You felt that really, like, musically, it was really, really shaped who you've become.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the other thing was that 2 years after getting there, I became a born again Christian. So there was a whole gospel Christian contemporary music vocabulary that I came to understand. And I worry sometimes when I write, it's like, that sounds really familiar. Who have I taken that from? and I sort of like just sit around waiting to get busted, you know, but nothing's happened yet. Being in Guyana, I was there when dancehall happened. And music changed overnight with that. And I'm not aware of experiencing anything quite like that. Maybe when Oasis happened and this whole Britpop idea took place was similar. But when I got to Guyana, people were dancing to Bob Marley. And then Bonnie Wailer put out something called Schools Out, which was a sort of hip hop thing. And then another guy put out The Most Dangerous Diseases. And then suddenly all of the music was this dancehall stuff. Bob Marley was old school and tired, and the kids didn't care about Bob Marley anymore. People started having sex with their clothes on. You know, that the dancing went from like the 12-inch rule in between to kind of like serious bumping and grinding.
And, wow.
Yeah. So I'm starting.
Scandalous, I suppose, at the time. Was it? Phil Gaughan was scandalous. Shock factor, you know.
I can't imagine many parents being happy that their teenagers were cavorting on the dance floor like that. What a thing to
witness, or to witness firsthand. Must have been amazing.
Yeah, I'm glad I was there for that.
And so, what age were you when you returned back to the UK?
21.
Oh, okay, and then so. At that time, was that when you did the Thieves thing? Is it around that time when you started creating music? Or how did you get from landing back in the UK to that stage where you had released some music? I mean, what was that little period? How long was that?
Well, I was a born-again Christian whilst I was there. I mean, I came back here and I was in the church for a bit. But one of the conflicts I had was that I was gay as well. And certainly the Christian denomination that I was a part of, you know, wasn't having that. It was an abomination. So I came back here and I continued to struggle with it. And one day I thought, okay, I've done all the praying, I've done all the fasting, I've done all of that stuff. So obviously, you know, I'm not going to change. So I'm going to have a bloody good time before I burn in hell, which I no longer believe. But then it was like that. I remember thinking, well, I'm not going to church anymore. So what else is there? I thought, well, people have been saying that I should join, that I'm a good singer. Maybe I'll try joining a band. I went around to see a friend who was into indie music. And she had the copy of the Melody Maker. I saw an ad in the back and I answered it. And I've been doing this ever since. That was
amazing.
That was like 1990.
You got a very unique singing style. That was always how you sang from the start. Was it just kind of naturally how your voice came out?
I'm quite astonished by it, really. People say that my voice is recognizable. They say it's distinctive. They say it's unique. They say it's feminine. They say all kinds of things about it. They say that I'm one of the best. And I don't know what they're talking about. So, I mean, every now and then I might get a little bit drunk and hear myself and think, oh, bloody hell, you are good. But that kind of has to happen. I can't think of a moment where I've ever thought that sober.
I don't think any of us do, to be fair. We're all our own worst critics, I think. But I've been listening back to a lot of your stuff in researching this, and listening to the theme stuff, it's recognisably you singing, you know, and it's and then you had the Thieves, and that kind of, is it right in saying that kind of project or that band broke up, but you took the songs and released it under your own name?
We decided that we wouldn't work together anymore, but we were already signed to Hut, and Hut was like, well, we've invested all this money, someone has to go on the road and promote this record, so. It'll happen, preferably David, and Saul's position at the time was, well, he's not going on the road as thieves. So we decided that we call it McAlmon. And I never liked that because I thought it was a thieves record. I didn't think it was a McAlmon record.
Either la 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 la, here and now's too long.
What I'm always very impressed by is these artists who have this sense of enterprise. You know, some people who, okay, I'm obscene example. Well, not obscene, extreme example. Beyoncé, right? She seems to be businesswoman, entrepreneur, singer, dancer, everything. Like really turned up to 10. That's not me. So the last thing I thought when Saul and I decided that we were going to part ways was that all of this legal wrangling would take place and name blah blah blah. I didn't see all of that coming, and slowly over time I've kind of like began to appreciate that really you do have to take care of business as well. But still really rotten at it. I mean, I really just wanted to show up, do my singing, and go on stage, do that. And get paid for it, lovely. But you know, tax and accountants and royalties and mechanicals and all that stuff, it's like, you know, a glaze over. Quite
natural. Artists are not designed for that, for this business world. That's the issue. It's basically these days you kind of have to have a working knowledge of all of those things and be all of those things that used to have, the record companies used to have departments for all of those things and people to do all those things. And right. And now we sort of find that we have to be all of those things ourselves. And that's just, I think it's a lot to ask of somebody to have that artistic brain and that business brain, which don't really mix. They don't often occupy the same head.
Yeah, and I think there's a real, well, I say that, but up until when I was quite active in it, which was probably about, around the millennium, I did McCammon Butler, the second McCammon Butler album in 2002, and then after that I just started moving into other areas. But up until that point, as I look back now, I think one of the things that was missing was that council, was that some persons, people in the industry who would sit you down and advise you actually what it was that you're getting into. I never had that conversation. I'd like to think that if I ran a record company, which is never going to happen, but I would say, okay, music business, you do understand what that means to you, do you, to my artist? It's like, you know, yes, you are making music, but you are also a business, you know? And a lot of the consequences of what happens for your record, I think it would have been very useful for me to hear that at the outset. But instead, all of these weird things started happening, weird, unexpected things, records taking off, me not expecting them to take off, and just kind of finding myself in the midst of a storm a lot of the time.
But do you mind talking about the McAlmon and Butler stuff? Are you happy to talk about that?
Not at all.
But so how did you, I mean, that's, I mean, yes, is that obviously it's a radio staple. It's instantly recognisable. Huge hit.
Yeah, I know, 25 years of it playing on the radio. I was like, whoa. pay some bills.
Yeah. So what was it like? I mean, how did that come about with Bernard Butler? Because he was obviously from Suede and was obviously a huge, you know, name. How did that sort of come about with did you meet up and stuff? Or what was that? How did that collaboration start?
I'm not sure what the official version is, but what actually happened was that shortly after I'd left, I stopped working with Saul, Bernard stopped working with Suede, and my managers knew his manager. I was with Martin Patton and Richard Lowe of MRM Management, and Berlin was being managed by Jeff Tramps at Rough Trade. And they knew each other. And one of them, I think my manager said to Jeff, "We've had this crazy idea. It might work. What do you think?" And Jeff was like, "Yeah, that could work." Because Jeff had toyed with the idea of signing me. And one night at the Jazz Cafe, Jeff brought Bernard to see the show. And then afterwards I went up. And it was quite a thing because Bernard was Bernard. You know, it's like, whoa, Bernard Butler's in the audience. It was that kind of buzz. It was a thing. The best new band in Britain's guitarist is in the audience. And afterwards I went to meet him. And he said the magic words. He said that he'd been working on songs inspired by Dusty Springfield and Scott Walker. And that lit my eyes up. Wow. I was like, ooh, say no more. I'm up for that. I went round to his house the next day. And actually, it was just one song. And Bernard's vision for this was he wanted to write the happiest imaginable song. So he listened to loads and loads of Dusty Springfield and Scott Walker. I'm not sure why he listened to Scott Walker so much. I don't think happy when I think about it.
No.
It might have been Sout's scale of sound. Right. And he dangled this massive carrot. He said, "Okay, I've sent this song to Julian Reagan, Kirsty MacColl, and Morrissey, and they all turned it down." And I'm like, "Really?" I said, "I'm having some of that." So I took it home, and my determination was like, "Right, this goes nowhere else." And yeah, that's how Yes came about. Yeah, but really, and it was fine with me. Bernard just wanted it to be that single. But the record company talked us out of it. It's like, no, you can't do that. You have to have an album. You have to have an album. And so we didn't actually make one. We just released two singles. And back in those days, I don't know if do you remember CD1 and CD2?
What do you mean in my way?
When you release a single, you release CD1 on the first week with a couple of B-sides.
Okay.
And then on week two, you release the same single with additional B-sides.
Oh, okay. Right, yes.
That was a way of hyping your single into the chart.
Yes, right? I've got like, many, actually. I've got many, many, many singles I bought twice, yeah.
Yes, CD1 and CD2. So we did that. And we did that for the second single, You Do. And that meant that we had an album. So when we released it, it kind of went into the charts, like in the lower reaches of the 30s, because everybody already had the material. And then that was it for 7 years.
Well, it's one of the, I think it's one of the iconic listens of the 90s. That, I mean, that was one of the, it's like, you know, it was such a huge. I mean, Yes is obviously a massive song, but the whole album itself was just brilliant. I think I remember hearing it blaring through the walls of my older brother's room. He was massive into the album at the time, so that's when I first heard your voice.
Okay.
Was coming through the bedroom walls, and he was my he was 2 years older than me, Liam. He was kind of the one that was listening to the most music. He was also the coolest music listener. So I was always the one, I always looked up to him. So I thought, oh, that's got to be good if Liam listened to it. So that's a good compliment to you.
Thanks, Liam.
So how did you, what was the writing like? Was it you were doing the top line stuff and Bernard was doing the other stuff? Or was it, what was it like to write that material?
For Yes, I wrote the top line. For You Do, we wrote the top line together. For the rest of the material, we just messed around, and that's one of the things. I thought, well, okay, you're kind of set, you're serious for what's going to be the A side, and then when you get to the B side for CD1 and CD2, you can like just mess around and be experimental. And so my attitude to them was, well, these are not singles, these are B sides, so do whatever you want. Behave differently to the way you would if you're trying to get someone on the radio. So when people say that they really like it now, I think that must be because we weren't being contrived. It was just Bernard saying, "What do you think of this?" And I'd say, "Well, that sounds good. Can I sing it in the bar? Can I sing it in the bathroom? There's a nice echo in there." Or in the case of "You'll Lose a Good Thing," Bernard came up with this idea of like taping the keys down. So he taped down the key of E minor, apparently, and then just sat alongside there going, this drone playing. And I sang it along to that. But I never imagined in a million years that people, until now, would be saying, what a great album that is, because I thought, well, we didn't really make an album. We just messed around. We made two great A sides, and then we messed around.
But maybe that approach sort of gave you some creative freedom, and you relaxed into it, and you were being more natural, letting things flow out. It's not a bad approach.
It's definitely echoed now with what I'm doing with Sean. Because the luxury there has been being away from the industry for years. It's like we just put out this single a couple of weeks ago called Bunker to Bunker, and the Black Madonna played it on Radio 1 one night. I haven't been on Radio 1 since Yes, I don't think. So that was like, wow, I'm on Radio 1? That's incredible.
Brilliant.
Excellent. I'm 53 years old and on Radio 1.
So I was going to ask you about that working with Hi-Fi Sean. I mean, that's what's that been like? Working, sort of getting back into it, because I know I can see by the releases it's been a bit of a hiatus. So how have you felt getting back into getting your sort of limbering back up again?
It's been great. One thing that it hasn't happened in the studio. And I kind of don't like studios. I feel like I'm cut off from the outside world, and I don't like air conditioning. And my preference is to get the record done and get onto the stage. That's where I'm happiest. But with Sean, it was on the 18th floor of a tower block in Mile End. So you had this incredible 180-degree view of London, and a couple of dogs, Barney and Fred, named after the Flintstones,
yeah.
And Sean's husband, who'd arrive home after work with food and cook, and then it was just me and Sean just doing what we wanted, And it's still like that, but now we're doing it remotely because he's in Kent, he's marooned in Kent, and I'm up here in London, so we're doing it remotely. But no, that's been an amazing experience, and. I think one of the things that's really special about it is that Sean is just really open to whatever I want to say. I mean, one of the things that I discovered whilst I was working with Bernard and up until I worked with Michael Nyman in 2009 was that lyric writing was a nightmare. It was pure pain. Because there was no confidence, complete insecurity. I didn't see myself becoming a songwriter or a lyric writer. And looking at a blank page and actually finally getting to a lyric was you know, I basically beat myself up along the way for not being any good at it. And then I thought, well, I've got to find a way to put a stop to this. And it was Brett Anderson. Brett Anderson said something in an interview about his lyric book. I was like, lyric book? What's that? And basically, he has an idea and he jots it down in his lyric book. So I do the same thing now. But if I start shaping an idea, if I start messing, it'd be better if that were, I abandon it. But if it's an idea that I feel able to just write down as it is, that goes into my phone list. And then I kind of upload it to my email every now and then, just so I don't, just in case I lose my phone. And then when I get the music from Sean, I go through that list and throw things and see what sticks. And strictly, I don't stray from that, because to do that would put me back into that place of despair.
Yeah, so, my phone's full of bits of lyrics and ideas. Sometimes it might just be a single line. And yeah. I used to kind of, if I had a line in my head, I used to just kind of discard it and think, if it's not going to become a song now, then but that's wrong now. And now, even if it's one line or even a couple of words, I sort of put it down. And those things have proven to do, they do become relevant at different times. You do find that those things will then pop out.
That's
and work.
It. I mean, a song that I write this week might have a phrase from 2016 in it, and then a couple of phrases from 2017, and then one that I wrote last month, and then one that I wrote yesterday. And just like compile those lines together, and the story presents itself. And I love that. It sounds like somebody else wrote it.
It was not a dismissive glance. It was the shame. Something happened when they let me down. I couldn't look your way, although I heard you when you said my name.
Working with Michael Nyman, yeah. I listened to some of that stuff. It was beautiful. So, what was it like working? Was it different, or was it? There was a lot of similarities with what you'd done before.
Oh my god, it was the best thing ever. It was the best thing ever, and my absolute favourite experience before working with Sean. Because, I mean, for me, it was like Michael Nyman. It was like, it's the Peter Greenaway guy. Do you ever see any Peter Greenaway films?
No, I haven't.
Right. I went to see a Peter Greenaway film years ago, and it just had this throbbing Baroque music. I mean, it's a minimalism. I think that's the school. I think that he would describe it as minimalism. And Michael would say that he came up with a minimalist system. But if you sit with Michael, and he's playing one of his pieces, sometimes there's like ding 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 a sequencer, and this completely mystified him. He's like, I don't see that, you know, I just have my system, I stick to it, and it's informed by Bach and fugues and canons and stuff like that, which is a language I don't understand. So I would call the album an album, he would call the album a song cycle, I would call it lyrics, he would call it the text, that sort of thing.
Right.
And what was interesting
So there was a language barrier at the start then.
Yeah. What was interesting about that was that most of Michael's fans hated it. But my fans loved it. I could hear pop, and I was responding to pop. I mean, there was one key change that he did in a song that ended up being City of Turin, where it sounded like a key change in a Stevie Wonder song that I knew. And he was like, I said, this is Motown. He's like, no, it's not. This is whatever he was referencing. But no, it came out, that was 2009. And I did some amazing shows at some amazing places. I played this place called Palau de Música in Barcelona. It's just
No, I haven't known.
And his band, I mean, his band. He just they're all recognizable instruments, but it wouldn't be the tenor sax. It would be the baritone sax. It wouldn't be the regular trombone. It would be the bass trombone. And so he got this whole kind of really edgy kind of honky brass sound. And then he's got this, you know, he's worked with these musicians for years. He's got Tony and Kate. Tony plays cello and Kate plays violin. And the two of them just, because that, you know, this action that I'm doing here, that's Michael's music. Doing that sort of thing. And it's just electric. Watching these guys, I mean, really exciting. And then it finally occurred to me one day that Martin, the bass player, was playing an electric bass. And so this whole kind of experimental classical minimalism being held together by an electric bass player. And I thought that was really interesting. Because you don't necessarily notice that because of the drama of all the other instruments. Martin sort of like just blends into the background. He's quite a unassuming guy anyway. But yeah, I loved it. I mean, when they played the shows, I was very much backstage looking at them, doing their thing, just sweating, because they work so hard. He makes them, he pushes them, but then he's there too. I mean, if you try playing a piano like that constantly for about 5 minutes, I can't imagine doing that. I think my biceps would seize up after a while. But no, I mean, it was great. It was pure musicianship by musicians working together. And the reason that we didn't do a lot more, because it's pretty expensive to pay for 15 musicians to go on tour. And then Michael Nyman. He's an Oscar-nominated composer. Yeah. So, you know, he was expensive. He expected to be treated well. But I think the highlight of it was that we wrote a song about a woman who was trafficked to Turin in Italy from Benin in Nigeria. And we wrote her story. And then a newspaper in Italy wrote about the song and about her story. And then we got invited to go and do the song cycle at the Savoy Summer Palace in the old capital.
Can't go home, I hate it here. The wind gets through the flimsy things they make me wear. Nobody here wants to hear the truth of how it's been for a girl on the street in the city of Turin. After dark in Valentino Park, they took away my passport and left a star. And my friend died because she couldn't lie. Truth is sinner on the street in the city of Turin.
There was piece of music that he reclaimed from a past soundtrack that wasn't released that he gave to me. It sounded to me like a great coming together, like people coming together from all across the globe to do something. And I found this story about a prostitution, people trafficking ring smashed in Seville. And I looked into it and I started reading all of these reports. That was a great thing about The Glare as well, was that I researched every song quite heavily. So I was looking into these reports about people being trafficked to Oslo, Seville and Turin. And Turin I went for because Turin reminded me of my sister's fascination with the Shroud of Turin. And I thought, okay, well, most people would associate the Shroud of Turin with Turin and not people trafficking. So let's write about that. And that's why the song became called The City of Turin. And we wrote the song and we released the album and with the stories behind each song. And then the newspaper picked up on it. We got invited by Turin to go and perform it at this lavish Savoy Summer Palace, and she showed up.
Oh,
she
wow.
She came, and I was just standing there eating a banana. Standing backstage, like, oh, because I was hungry, and we've been on it all day. And then she walked in, and she just came to say, I want you to know who I am. And I'm like, I know who you are. It was extraordinary. So I love that experience, and I'd love to work with Michael again.
So with the obviously at the moment there's no live shows, but are you tentatively making plans to play live with Sean?
Not at the moment. I mean, I think I spent a lot of this time looking around to see what's going on and how people do things. What I'm interested in doing right now is just really upgrading my home setup so that I can produce and broadcast from home. So I like purchased a podcast bundle, and I'm going to get my computer upgraded and going to start investing in that kind of thing. Because I never really have, really, but the uncertainty of how this ends, you know, of how this goes, is, you know, even if there is a vaccine, who's going to get it, you know?
I mean, I've been looking into the live stream side of things, but I feel like it's a thing that could be here to stay. The live streaming thing, is that something that you're interested in? Singing live, or was it more like speaking podcast kind of broadcast stuff? What were you looking to do?
Well, probably treat it like Facebook, really. You have these things available to you, or organically, your thing will just emerge. The headline is my interest, so it's history, art, and music. But you know, that's the only headline I have. I mean, I spend the weeks looking at music and investigating music and history. And I love art, so the idea of bringing those things together into a podcast is intriguing. But I don't exactly know what the format will be yet, because I haven't figured out the equipment. I've got a load of manuals to read. Now that it's month five, to month five, can you feel me? You gotta give me a little hope, cause when it's sashaying in our love in small places. Degree in the history of art, and that again is another of the great things that I could have done for myself. It got me to heaps of debt, but I just wanted to. I mean, I think that we speak a lot about the influences, and we speak a lot about the mechanics and the practice. But keeping ourselves inspired, I think that's a really important conversation as well. And to me, art history wasn't just art. It was the history, it was the philosophy, it was language, it was geography, it was all of those different things. And ever since then, I've not really struggled, I've not really felt blocked about creating anything. It just flows out. So that would be a recommendation that I would make. Go and get yourself, don't get yourself an art history degree.
Well, I was going to say about the recommendations, we always do a recommendation part, but I've never had anybody recommending getting a degree before.
Well, you can get one. You sign up. Universities need the money, so the degree will be there, and you will be pushed to the limit of your capacity. it's just not possible to absorb everything that comes at you. But it shaped me for life. The things that I was interested in there, I'm still interested in. I feel that I need to keep looking at them, you know? But it means that I can be excited about going to the Uffizi. Going to the Uffizi is like going to a rock concert. It's like, yeah, look, it's Perugino. Yeah. But yes, I mean, the student loans people will give you the money to go, and then you have to earn a certain amount to pay them back, which you can do. We don't have to, but I mean, that's the lie of the land. So why not? You can do night school at Birkbeck. You can do it part time. You can take 2 years or 4 years. You do feel the benefit of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time that we can spend around waiting for things to happen. You know, I mean, I was writing essays backstage at the Hideaway.
Wow.
Hideaway is the place where I met Alex, who I did the Last Bohemians album with, which was a lovely surprise drop last year. He said, "Do you want to make an album?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Great, it's coming out in November." That's the way that Alex worked. But he came down to the Hideaway to see me perform, and that's where the conversation started. But often, whilst I was at the Hideaway, like getting ready to do a Prince show or a Bowie show or a George Michael show or a Dusty Springfield show, I had my laptop back and I was like, you know, kind of typing out Fra Angelico quotes and stuff.
This is the Need to Know Music show, so we do ask for a musical recommendation as well as an educational one. Is there somebody you would like to recommend that people could check out that maybe they haven't heard of before, or what would be your recommendation?
Zamrock. You familiar?
No, I'm not.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. Zamrock. When we were in the 60s, 70s, Faces, Floyd, that whole transition into psychedelic music, Africans were listening, and Africans created, they emulated that sound. So you have these African guys in Zambia, you know, who loved these British musicians, you know, trying to recreate that sound in Africa with all of those African inflections and that European influence. It's fantastic. That's
amazing.
Look for Zamrock, Zamrock.
So we'll have all the links to all your stuff, and so people can check out everything that you're doing now with Sean. And just like to say thanks for, it's an absolute pleasure chatting to you, and a real honour for me to chat to you. So thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.